You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you and good afternoon. Welcome to part two of the John C. Scott Show. More Democrats calling more loudly for impeachment proceedings against President Trump after his latest defiance of Congress by blocking the former White House lawyer from testifying. How long can he get away with this? And how much pressure is building toward impeachment in the House? Let's talk with the former chair of the Democratic Party in Pima County, one of the best defense lawyers in America. Here's Jeff Rogers. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, John.
Well, what do you think? The pressure's building on impeachment. Is this a good idea for the Democrats politically?
I think it is. The walls are closing in on Trump. We've now got two court decisions involving two different judges and involving three sets of subpoenas to Mazars, his accounting firm, with one judge in a federal district court, and another judge ruled that Capital One and Deutsche Bank have to turn over records to Congress to the committees investigating that as well. And those are the Financial Services and Intelligence Committees. So the walls are closing in. As I predicted, the courts are going to be on the side of our Constitution and the laws of the land. And, you know, the Trump administration, frankly, to tell you the honest to God truth, there's a rule in the federal court called Rule 11. And that means you have to have a good faith in the filings that you file, or it's misconduct for a lawyer to file pleadings that they don't have a good faith basis in the law already established or an extension of the law as it exists. And the case they cited, the Trump lawyers, is absolutely against him. It was a unanimous decision that ordered a nonprofit to turn over its records to Congress. So it's four square against them, and they made that argument anyway. It was a frivolous argument, as are most all of these arguments going to be. I mean, we go all the way back to United States versus Nixon, where the Supreme Court unanimously ordered Nixon to turn those tapes over. So, you know, they're going to lose in the courts. You might find some frivolous panel that just has a few Trump appointees, but I don't think that you're going to find a federal appellate panel that will buy the Trump's arguments, and I don't think you're going to find that even in the Supreme Court. I bet it'd be unanimous today that he has to turn this over. This is longstanding constitutional law, and they're going to have to turn this stuff over, and Trump is absolutely terrified, hence his hissy fit temper tantrum today, because he knows that they're closing in on him, and it's still going to take time because they can run out the game in a four corners offense by appealing all of these things. But you know, there may be a point in time where some of these federal courts say we're going to deny a stay, and a stay is where you basically leave things as they are right now and don't pursue, you know, don't order them to turn the records over right now. And you know, they may not get a stay, and if they don't get a stay, the records are going to be delivered, and they're going to have to jump fast to the Supreme Court.
Well, how long can they play this out? How protracted can it be, Jeff?
Well, you know, the federal district courts have moved pretty quickly on these cases involving these three financial institutions. So I think the appellate court's process slows things down, but you know, that could be a couple of months. And we could solve it in a couple of months, depending on how fast the track it gets on. And then now we're sitting there with going to the full panel. That's where you usually a three-judge panel. If the panel, if you disagree with their decision, you can ask for a non-bank hearing, which is before the full panel of that district court. And so that drags the process on a little longer. Sometimes you can just say skip that process and file what's called a petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court and ask them to intervene at that point in time. But that'll speed the process up. But that's, you know, what the Trump administration did in their anti-Muslim acts. So, that's a double-edged sword for them because, you know, on the one hand, it speeds it up, which they don't want. On the other hand, they think that's their best chance, which I don't think that's going to happen. I think every one of these courts is going to recognize Congress's oversight authority and their ability to subpoena records.
How much confidence do you have in the Supreme Court being unbiased in this regard? These are Trump appointees, a couple of them, and obviously majority conservative court. What's your take on the politics of the court? Or is there such a thing? There shouldn't be, but is there?
You know, the four more liberal, they're really not that liberal, but they're more liberal than the other five. They're going to, of course, follow precedent. I mean, they only need one more vote. And I don't see John Roberts, you know, throwing the court under the bus for, you know, this corrupt president. I just don't see that happening. So that's five. And once you get to five, you know, there's a sense in which some of the other people will look at it and go, you know, what if the shoe's on the other foot? You got a Democratic president who's abusing his power and as corrupt as Trump is. We want to send a message that, you know, Congress has this authority and we're going to reaffirm that authority, and that's that. So when you get to five, it's easy to get to six and easy to get to seven and then eight and then nine.
The politics of the impeachment, let's go to both sides of it here. You've told me from time to time you're skeptical of whether this is the best political move for the Democrats for 2020. But the power within the responsibility of the power of the Congress of the United States is for oversight. And that includes impeachment of the president if there's wrongdoing. And my question is, politics or not, how important is it for this Congress to move ahead with this, even though there may not be Senate votes and there probably won't be? So,
well, I think it's reached a point where they have to act. I think impeachment is around the corner because of his obstructive behavior in all of these investigations and them having to go to the courts. The fact is that sometimes I think that we overanalyze what happened to the Bill Clinton impeachment. Remember back when that happened, it was in the midterm elections of 1998, and they started the impeachment proceedings just a few months before the election. This is more than a year and a half before the election. So that's totally different, okay? And not only that, but do you know what President Clinton's approval rating was at the time they started the impeachment proceedings?
No,
not when they voted on him, but when they start, 73% approval rating.
Whoa.
The economy was as hot as can be. It was, you know, these were big times. We were paying down the deficit. We were, you know, I mean, these were big times. He led an economic resurgence, and so approval rating at 73%. And we're not talking about a president with a 73% approval rating. We're talking about a president who, in today's polling, is now back down to 40% approval rating, and you've got 54% of the people who say they will never vote for Trump. So, you know, the fact is that we may be currently what happened in 1998, And frankly, it doesn't matter. It's their job and it's their duty, and this has gone far enough. I mean, he's being obstructive in every one of these investigations. You'll remember that when they filed the articles of impeachment against Nixon, the last article of impeachment was obstruction of Congress.
Wow. Well, I was not aware of that.
And this man has done more to obstruct Congress than Nixon and his wildest dreams could dream of.
What about the, we talked about the politics of impeachment. As we move forward, how does impeachment improve the ability of the Congress to get what they've been wanting, which is financial records, taxes, testimony of all kinds of people? How does the impeachment process, once it begins, aid that effort?
Well, some legal scholars believe that it puts Congress in an even more powerful position than they already are vis-a-vis their subpoena power, because now they're sitting as a court, if you will, and their subpoena power is stronger as a quasi court or judicial branch at that point in time. So, you know, some people argue that's a good reason to start impeachment anyway. The other thing that starting impeachment would do is it would centralize all of these investigations. We've now got, you know, more than a dozen and a half investigations of various committees of various misconduct by Trump and his administration. And this would centralize all of that into the Judiciary Committee, which would be investigating everything in one committee.
Well, as Democrats weigh their options, Trump's almost taunting them, I guess. It seems like it, by testing the bounds of the executive power, I think, in ways that few other administrations ever have. The White House contends that even former employees like Mike McCann don't have to abide by subpoenas, and he goes on and on saying, we don't care what you want, we don't care what you think you have, we don't care what you say, we're not going to give you what you want, period. Unbelievable.
Well, and I think it's interesting to see that just, about 6 months ago, you have a memo coming out from the legal division of the Internal Revenue Service, written by a lawyer in that section, who basically says we have no choice but to turn over his taxes. Of course we have to. The law requires it. And then they mentioned something about, well, maybe executive privilege, but that has nothing to do with executive privilege. Executive privilege only narrowly protects the president and his advice from his senior members of his staff and their discussions about policy level issues. So that doesn't come into play at all. So, you know, you've got their own IRS telling them that we got to turn this over, and yet they're still refusing.
Let's go to Joe on our phone lines. And Joe, you're with Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I'm with Mike Dudes. How are you guys doing? It's good to hear you guys.
Thank you.
Hey, Jeff, you know what? I am, if you can go up the chain of all your lawyer connections and have Chuck Schumer stop fast-tracking Donald Trump's federal appointed judges. He has made me sick with helping Trump set a record. And we saw how much, you know, we saw what those guys did to not only Merrick Garland, but the whole process. What do you think about that?
Joe, once they went nuclear on this and said that the power and denied any kind of powers to the Democrats, we're stuck. They only need 51 votes all the time. We have no say.
Yeah, but why do we have, like, you know, I heard, like, Cory Booker, and I heard, Kirsten Gillibrand was saying that, no, she wouldn't do the 51 votes, that she would take it back to what it was before. And I'm like, you know, I just think Chuck Schumer could be doing a lot more than fast-tracking. I think he's been rolling out.
I disagree with Gillibrand and Schumer on that, Joe. I disagree with
them.
I think, you know, they've taken this to a nuclear level. And if we take control of Congress and the Senate, we need to do the same. We need to undo the damage they've done. This era of being polite, we can't be polite and gentlemanly while they're being this way. I mean, that just, it doesn't work that way.
All right, Joe.
Yeah, spot on.
All right.
Take care, folks.
Thanks. Jeff, you've got 235 Democrats, 197 Republicans in the majority of the House of Representatives, and the Speaker Pelosi would likely, I think, find support for starting impeachment proceedings, but it could be somewhat of a tighter vote than the margin suggests. Some lawmakers say voters back home are more interested in health care, more interested in the economy. Many come from more conservative districts where they need to run for re-election in communities where Trump also has support. The politics of that, with that, those numbers I just shared with you, is that troublesome for the House?
I don't think so. I think if the average American sat down and read the Mueller report, they would be aghast, and they would say, he's got to go. But the problem is, it's 450-odd pages, and it's actually quite well written, and it's a good read. But the average American is not going to sit down and do that. The average American will turn their television on at night and watch sound bites from these committee hearings on impeachment, as we did. I mean, we were sitting there with bated breath in 1974. I mean, I was rushing home from work, and in the summer, I had a summer job before college, and, you know, to hear the latest news on that. People were glued to their televisions and their newspapers. So, you know, people will pay attention to that kind of live stuff a lot more than they will to a report that they have to go through 450 pages.
Jeff, there's no question this is going to drag on through the summer. But by fall, we should have some definitive results of all of this, don't you think? I mean, we might tread on water with all the talking heads through the summer, but by fall, we got to have something that's going to happen one way or another.
Well, and here's the other thing is that, as I said, this delay by the Trump people is a double-edged sword, because the more delay they get, the more these decisions by federal courts against them start coming out while the election's starting to heat up. And that's going to look bad. Another federal court rules against Donald Trump and his administration today, saying they improperly withheld subpoenas and withheld testimony from Congress. You know, and so now you start getting a drumbeat of that stuff coming out, and it's coming out during the election cycle. That can't be good for Trump or the Republicans, you know, the spineless Republicans who will do nothing.
Jeff Rogers, always great talking with you. I really appreciate you being on the show. I get great response every time you're on. That's why we do this. Thank you.
Right. My pleasure.
All right. Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, one of the best defense lawyers in America. Coming up next, investigative reporter Jim Small from the Arizona Mirror, which is a group of investigative reporters that publish their work online under Arizona Mirror. It's an amazing group of investigative reporters that cut to the chase and get to stories that nobody else gets to in the capital of the state. We'll be back with Jim Small after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum. Thanks so much for being with us now in our 31st year of continuous political talk. Jim Small is my guest next. He's an investigative reporter with Arizona Mirror, which is a group of investigative reporters that publish their work online. Jim is the former editor of the Capital Times, and we always thank him very much at the Capital News of the legislature. And here's Jim Small. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing, John?
I'm doing very well. We've got Republican legislative leaders saying they've reached a deal on the spending plan with the governor, but they still have to sell it to the rank and file. You get some holdouts who want what they want, and they're not going to give the full Senate, in this particular case, what the Senate wants unless they get what they want. How serious are these so-called folks looking for a way here to get what they want?
I think that they're very serious, and I think it seems by all accounts from what we've been kind of hearing today is that, you know, this is a very dynamic situation. Things are changing, you know, kind of by the minute here. But that, you know, leadership and the governor's office, I think, are taking these, you know, these holdouts seriously and are working to try to meet their concerns, you know, in a way I think that that satisfies both you know, the individual senator or representative. And also, you know, allows, you know, it's something that the broader caucus can accept and that the governor's office can accept, really, at the end of the day. And so, you know, those things are all in, you know, kind of in transit at the moment. I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening. We've already seen a couple of people who had been holding out their votes on the budget. Now say that they are on board the budget because of changes that have been promised to be made. One of those was Scottsdale Republican Michelle Eugenti Rita, who had been holding out her vote over the car registration fee, the $32 registration fee that every Arizonan has to pay to license their car. You know, they were going to get rid of that. She'd made that had been a big issue for her all year. They were going to get rid of that over 5 years, and she said, "I'm not going to support a budget that doesn't do it. And if it takes more than 2 years to get rid of this tax." And ultimately, it looks like that they have backed down, and they are going to get rid of it over 2 years instead of 5 years. So, you know, that's the example of the kind of thing that you know, that they're doing to try to, you know, gather the 16 votes in the Senate and the 31 votes that they need in the House.
Well, in the House, though, they have such a narrow margin of 31. And they had been reluctant to even bring bills to the floor because they had somebody missing or somebody just simply wasn't available for that vote. What's the situation in the budget? Are there all 31 that are going to get a Republican vote out of that very slim majority, Jim?
It looks like it so far. I mean, we haven't really most of the action on people talking about holding up their vote has been in the Senate so far, not in the House. You know, the one caveat to that is there is one Republican from Mesa, Kelly Townsend, who says that she will vote no on one of the accompanying budget bills. It's not a bill that actually appropriates money. It's one that deals with the policy needed to implement the budget. That she's going to vote no on that policy bill unless she gets her way on an unrelated proposal to basically penalize school districts if teachers talk about politics or share their political ideology in the classroom.
You got to be kidding me.
Really? I am not kidding you.
You're not kidding me. You're serious.
No, hey, you know, this is a plan that she, again, this is one of those things that, you know, she has been working on all year long. She had bills earlier this session that would have actually fined teachers and would have allowed school districts, would have, in fact, required school districts to fire teachers if they did this. Her new approach is to actually go after the districts and not the teachers. This is, you know, really fundamentally, I think, about retaliating against teachers who organized last year for the Red for Ed movement. And finding a way to, you know, basically go after them and, you know, make it more difficult for them, for teachers to talk to their students and to, you know, the parents of their students about, you know, about the state of education funding and, you know, a desire. Certainly, we saw that last year with the, you know, a lot of teachers and people who supported education who came out for the Red for Ed movement, to try to keep that from happening again in the future.
Tell me about conformity. We're not going to go there this time around, but how did that leave the state without, a couple hundred million we probably could use? What's going on with that?
I'm sorry, say that again, John?
Conformity with the feds.
Oh.
Nothing happened, right? We're not going to go.
Well, that's part of the budget, too. That is included in the budget negotiations. And so basically what they did is they're going to conform, which means the state is going to get more money. And in order to mollify Republicans who saw that as a tax increase, what they're going to do is they're going to do a corresponding changes to the income tax code. In Arizona, they're going to consolidate the number of brackets. Currently, there are 5 income tax brackets. The proposal right now calls for it to move to 4 brackets, but I'm hearing that they may actually amend that and make it down to 3 brackets. And then on top of that, they're going to cut the rates basically for everybody. I think the only people who would not be paying a different rate are the people who make the lowest amount of money in the state right now, who make, I want to say it's like under $26,000 a year. Would be paying the same income tax rate that they do currently. So that is, the idea is basically to, on the one hand, take in more money because of tax conformity, and on the other hand, kind of try to give it back to the taxpayers in the form of income tax cuts and kind of really streamlining the brackets by reducing the number of brackets that we have.
We're talking with Jim Small of Arizona Mayor. Is it fair to say the Democrats were pretty much left as spectators? They were never consulted nor included in the budget talks, and it's still an all-Republican show because they've got 31 votes in the House and they have 3-vote margin in the Senate, so they don't need the Democrats and don't want them, apparently.
That is the way it works. Yep, and in a lot of regards, that's as close as the margins may be this year compared to normal, other years in the past. This is kind of this is the process. This is the way it happens, and this is what we've seen, for a long time, where Democrats really aren't brought to the table. And the only time they are is if the Republicans absolutely need to get 1 or 2 votes, and then they only deal with 1 or 2 Democrats, not with the entire caucus.
Well, there you go. By the way, the whole idea about smoking, whatever happened with that bill is that we were at the end of the session here. Did they increase the age and offer more restrictions on smoking? What did they do with smoking?
No, they haven't dealt with that. The smoking and vaping stuff has, they haven't gotten any final resolution on that. Assuming that the budget does get done this week, and I think it's looking increasingly likely that it will, then that means that they will probably come back next week after the Memorial Day holiday to kind of finish up the session and try to wrap things up and go home. So, if there's going to be a resolution to those smoking and vaping bills, I think we will probably know, within a week what's going to happen with those.
Well, it wasn't a lot of money, but it angered a lot of people when you added $32 to their registration tags for their automobiles. The lawmakers said, well, wait a minute, when the governor first proposed this, we thought it was $18, now it's $32. What'd they ever do with that?
That was kind of what I was talking about earlier with Michelle Eugenti was I think leading the charge against that bill among Republicans. It looks like they are going to get rid of that fee, that tax. It is going to be phased out over 2 years. So my guess is for the upcoming year, I haven't seen the exact details on it, but that they'll knock that fee down from the $32 down to either, maybe $18 or $16 in the upcoming year. And then the year after that, it'll go away entirely.
There's a lot of unfinished business. They were going to do oversight of charter school management and expenditures that were obviously just alarming to almost anybody that saw the way some of these charter school companies had spent their money. And that didn't happen. I guess it's probably something they'll take up again. But there's a lot of unfinished business. They were going to do some kind of justice reform. That didn't happen. What else was unfinished by this legislative session, but now that we're almost at the end of it, Jim?
Yeah, those two, I think, were really prominent. I mean, the tax conformity was something that had been looming since last year that is finally getting taken care of. Teacher raises are another thing, education funding that is being addressed to some degree within this budget. Certainly, I think, advocates from the public education community would tell you that that's not enough. I think, I do think though that the charter schools issue, you know, really probably stands as sort of the biggest thing that people expected to be addressed during the session, that really just kind of went by the wayside and died for, you know, in large part because you have, you know, you have one faction that says that the reforms don't go far enough, and another faction that says the reforms go too far and stymie charter schools. And so, you know, when that's the case, I mean, you're kind of left with, you know, an inability to find a coalition to pass reforms. And so what you get is the status quo.
Jim, tell everybody about Arizona Mirror, why you formed this group of investigative reporters, your purpose, your mission, and where you are right now with the whole process.
Yeah, so, you know, we are an independent nonprofit newsroom based out of the Capitol. And you know, we exist to cover the state capitol and state politics, but hopefully, you know, we really want to do it in a way that kind of demystifies this place and kind of shines a light on what actually happens down here. And we're not writing for, you know, insiders. We're not writing for lobbyists. We're not writing for, you know, the bureaucrats who, you know, already are engaged in what's happening in politics and government. You know, we really want to be able to tell stories about and talk to, you know, regular Arizonans, folks who don't have the, you know, whether it's a luxury or a curse of, you know, spending all their time at the Capitol and following what's going on in government. You know, we're here to do that, and we want to be able to explain to people why what happens at the Capitol is important and why the decisions, when it comes to public policy, the decisions that get made by officials are important, and how they affect people's lives, how they help people, and you know, also how they hurt people. You know, and so we really focus our stories on you know, trying to write about those things that don't get covered elsewhere, and tell the stories that you know, largely go untold. You know, were it not for you know, my great team of reporters going out and finding the people and telling their stories.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. You've got some of the best investigative reporters in the country all together. That had to make you feel really good when you look around that table going, wow, this is pretty cool.
It's an incredible group of people with some, you know, fantastic backgrounds and skill sets and you know, just a great enthusiasm and eagerness to, you know, go out and cover the government and you know, really be able to hold folks accountable and be able to, you know, hopefully get people engaged and get them interested in understanding why the government does what it does and who, you know, who they're really whose behalf they're working on when they're doing those things.
Jim, great to talk with you, and thanks for all your hard work with Arizona Mirror. People need to go to it to find out not only what's going on but what's coming off. Amazing group of reporters, and I thank you for talking about them and talking with us on our show today. We really appreciate it, Jim. Thank you.
You bet, John.
You bet. Jim Small of Arizona Mirror. Mo Goldman, our immigration lawyer, is up next on the John C. Scott Political Forum. But first, these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum. Mo Goldman is one of the best immigration lawyers in America, one of the most respected anywhere in this profession. His challenge gets greater and more difficult every single day with the administration and what is happening at the border. So let's find out what's happening at the border. Mo Goldman is with us. It doesn't get any better, Mo. It seems to be getting worse for you.
It does get more and more difficult as the days go by. And you're correct. It's tough. It's definitely a tough time to be an immigrant, to be an immigration advocate, immigration lawyer. We are definitely knee-deep in a lot of, you know, just very restrictive policies and policy changes that happen almost on a weekly basis. And so, you know, as an update, I think one of the most significant updates that came out earlier this week was that over 6,000 asylum seekers have thus far been returned to Mexico under the Migrant Protection Protocols, which is the government action where the Customs and Border Protection are forcing refugees or asylees to stay in Mexico while they're going through the asylum process. And then on top of that, the report is that even though initially the government was saying that it would be about a 45-day wait, the wait time is most likely going to be at least a year or longer to be waiting over in Mexico until they get their day in court for an immigration hearing, a judge hearing. So it's a horrible situation because it leaves these individuals in even more danger, potentially, just, you know, being in a place where they are a foreigner, they don't have, protection of the U.S. government, and they are, potentially in a dangerous location like Ciudad Juarez, which I think if I read correctly, this year alone, there's already been over 575 homicides in Ciudad Juarez. So,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an awful place or a place for somebody, especially with no, home or place to call a home, to be sitting and waiting, seeking protection from the U.S. government. So, yeah, it doesn't get any better from the perspective of the asylees, and it doesn't get much better when we see that someone like Ken Cuccinelli is going to be in a position. I think they were saying that the former Virginia Attorney General was going to be the immigration czar, which the White House pushed back on and said, no, he won't be the immigration czar, but he's going to have a high-level position in the leadership of the Department of Homeland Security. And he has been a very hardliner when it comes to immigration and immigration policies. So, you know, when we see someone like him being named in that type of role, we know that it's not going to get any easier anytime soon.
So, but the one, if somebody crosses the border, asks for asylum, they can be sent back to Mexico and remain there for up to a year or more before any determination. Is that
correct.
Where it is now? I mean, is that what the Constitution of the United States says? Yeah, you can ask for asylum, and under our Constitution, we have to hear your case, but we don't have to do anything about it until you're much older.
No, and that's what the challenge is right now in the courts. However, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals allowed the policy, the migration protection protocols, specifically related to the return to Mexico provision, to continue to go forward. And that's something I spoke about last week on our call. And even though they allowed that to stay in place, the court did indicate that most likely it will not be passing legal muster once they get to the bona fides or the bona fides of the case at chief or in chief when it talks about the actual legality and the constitutionality of this policy, because it's obviously from my perspective, an unconstitutional policy.
We're talking with Mo Goldman, who's an immigration lawyer. There are needs for workers out of this country, and we're in a situation now in which it seems to me the administration of those immigration proceedings is so convoluted and so crazy that we're really hurting companies that need people today, that thought they had people today, and they may not have them ever. Why are we doing this to ourselves?
Let me tell you a story. First of all, I'm going to tell you some recent developments when it comes to the labor force and immigrants working in the United States. But then also, I'm going to tell you a story that, you know, to me is appalling and should not happen anytime under our government. And first of all, I'll note that in the last 10 years, at least in the last decade, there has not been issuances of the what's called no match letter being sent out from the Social Security Administration. And the no match letter is a letter that notifies an employer that an employee's name and the Social Security number aren't matching in their records. Well, in the last, I'd say, like 2 or 3 months, the Social Security Administration has sent out 500,000, I think it was over 575,000 no match letters to employers. I guarantee you that the Trump organization did not get one of these letters, even though it's known that they were hiring undocumented immigrants. But these letters, the last time I recall these letters going out was under the Bush administration. They were, the whole policy was in place for many years, and then eventually it was halted by the Obama administration. And really, all it did was it put employers in the defensive, where they would have to do an investigation to figure out, you know, in some cases, they may have had workers that had given them Social Security numbers that, you know, were not valid, and they were just relying off of it. In other cases, it's a no-match letter due to the fact that the employer might have put down the wrong information, or, you know, their internal records were incorrect. And so the no-match letters will give them a certain amount of time to take corrective action. And, you know, in many cases, those individuals will probably leave the employment and not come back once they're contacted by the employer. So it's a way to get individuals who are undocumented working for these employers to leave. I mean, that's basically the mindset of the government in sending these out. Now, you know, there's a constant request from people who support the administration's current policies on immigration to do things the right and legal way, to follow the laws. And what we're seeing is, even if you try to follow the laws under this administration, you're going to get screwed. And here's an example. I have a client who works for a multinational corporation. He's a manager, relatively high level. It's a big company. And he filed for what's called an L-1A visa. The company petitioned him for it back in 2016, and it got approved. It was a little bit of a struggle, but, you know, it was always, most of these visa applications are a bit of a struggle to get approved, even under President Obama, under President Bush, under Clinton. It's always been a bit of a struggle, but in general, most of the applications get approved, most of them. And so he got approved and got a 3-year approval for this L1 visa. And he came here to work, brought his family. He's been very productive, been working, you know, pretty much constantly. And then he also was petitioned for to get a green card under the same category as a multinational manager, also approved. And then what happens is, after you file that petition and get approval, you can do the green card application, the actual, it's called adjustment of status application, which ultimately will become a green card. And that's currently in process. And as a part of that application, the individual can apply for a work permit and a travel permit, which would allow him to work and leave the U.S. To travel internationally, which a lot of multinational managers need to do, especially on the border. Well, that application got filed early November, and along the way, we filed for an extension of his L-1 visa, and, well, go figure. That same exact application that got approved back in 2016 and then got approved a second time for the green card petition was denied.
Why?
Because now the government has, or whoever the officer is that reviewed the application, has looked at it and said, this guy is not a manager. Well, how was he a manager back in 2016 by definition, and then again found to be a manager when we filed the green card petition and approved in 2018, but now all of a sudden he's no longer a manager? Well, the big difference is we're under the current executive order of Hire American, and these officers are taking that to heart, and they're denying petitions that were previously approved. But it gets worse. His current visa is going to expire at the end of the month, and his work permit application, which is a separate ability for him to work in the U.S., has been pending more than 6 months. And I mentioned last week that the processing times have hit such a slowdown that there was a letter that was drafted and signed by 36 senators, bipartisan, 18 Democrats, 18 Republicans, including Senator McSally, calling on the USCIS director, Francis Cisna, to explain to them why these processing times are so slow. Like, why would it take 6 months or more to process a plastic card for somebody to get their work permit, when in the past it's always taken 3 months or less? All of a sudden it's doubled or more. So the worst thing for this poor guy and his family and the employer is that his visa is no longer going to be valid by the end of the month, so he can't continue to work as of that date. And his work permit has been pending for more than 6 months, and we can't get anything expedited. And when I've contacted the senator's office, they're just getting inundated with these requests. We are wasting so much of our senator and congressional offices' times with immigration issues, especially ones that don't need to be a problem. Like, this is something that could be easily resolved. And it's just a disaster. And so then he's going to be stuck in the U.S. with the inability to work, which is exactly what Trump supporters don't want people to be doing. And he won't even be able to travel out of the U.S. because if he does leave, he abandons his green card application.
And he can't get back, that's for sure.
And he can't come back to the... Well, he wouldn't be able to get back, and he won't be able to get a visa to come back under our current
This is the nightmare.
I mean, it's the most absurd thing.
But, you know, this is becoming more convoluted and more screwed up every single day. I mean, the more the administration touches it...
You know, yeah. The system's imperfect, and immigration has always been railed against for not being efficient and being, you know, one of the most inefficient government agencies out there. But I know U.S. immigration officers who take pride in being efficient, and they don't like what's happening. You know, they're frustrated because cases like this are not ones a lot of times that they are dealing with. These are cases that are being dealt with in remote locations far away from where you or I are located. So, you know, it's just we're really in a horrible position. I really think that we'd be better off just outsourcing this work if we can't get it done efficiently in the U.S. Go figure.
Yeah, do it in India.
Yeah, I mean, they'll create the green cards and the work permits about, you know, five days.
You bet, instantly. You don't see under the administration's current appointments that they're making now or changes that they're making within Homeland Security. I don't see anything getting better soon. Do you?
No. Just like I said about Ken Cuccinelli, it's going to be as bad or worse for the next several months all the way till the election. I know that there's a bill currently before Congress about trying to give protection for Dreamers and DACA recipients and people with temporary protected status, and that would be great, but you know, it's highly doubtful that it's going to be a law at any time soon. So, you know, we're really in a dark time when it comes to immigration, and I think it's just a matter of having to plow through and hope that, you know, we come out on the other side, you know, maybe better in some way.
By the way, if anybody crosses the border, asks for protection, they're all being sent back. Nobody's getting granted any further hearings or any further processes other than saying, go back to Mexico to talk to you in a year. Everybody's being sent back?
You know, that's something I can't speak to. I don't think that the numbers indicate that. Like I said, it's been about 66,000 or 6,500 people so far, based off of the data I read in the paper. Well, I guess online. I haven't read the actual newspaper in some time, but, you know, which is a sad statement, especially when you hear what's happening with the printing. Didn't they move it out of Tucson for the Daily Star?
They did.
But, yeah, some people wind up, especially family units, in a situation like the ones that were being dropped off at the monastery. And so those aren't people who are being sent back, but there's definitely a percentage of them that are in this migrant protection protocol system.
Well, I thank you so much for talking about it, and
no problem.
We're going to continue to have this conversation. I want people to know not only what the hell's going on, but what the hell's coming off, and it's never any better, but we have to talk about it. And Mo, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're glad. Have a great day.
All right, glad to have you on. Mo Goldman, immigration lawyer. I want to thank Jim Nintzel, the editor of The Weekly, for his appearance on our show. Bruce Ash for Republican National Committeeman gave us a GOP perspective. Keith Rosenblum, who covers Mexico and has for 30 years, gave us a look at what's happening across the border. Jeff Rogers, the former chair of the Democratic Party, talked about impeachment. He says, full speed ahead, impeach him. And Jim Small, who is with the Arizona Mirror and his group of investigative reporters, talking about the drawn-out final weeks of the budget battle in Phoenix with the Arizona legislature. Then, of course, Mo Goldman, who is the immigration lawyer. Been an interesting show for me. I hope it has been for you. Thanks so much for listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This is KVY The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Coming up next, the best talk show in sports in America with Steve Rivera. That's right here at KVY The Voice. Keep listening. Thanks, everyone, for listening to our show. Have a great evening.